The hour of 8:15 having arrived, I call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We do have quorum. Our first item on the agenda is approval of the meeting minutes. Representative Chair Davis, have you had a chance to review the meeting minutes for March 25th, 2025?
I have, Madam Chair, and I'll move the minutes of March 25th, 2025.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Moves approval of the minutes for March 25, 2025. Any discussions? Seeing no discussions, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any oppose? The motion prevails, and the meeting minutes for March 25, 2025 are approved. Members, today we do have five bills up, and so it is a very packed agenda. We are limiting our testifiers to 2 minutes each, and so we are going to get the bill in the order that the author would like for it to be. We will have testifiers, and then we will go to member questions. And so if we could adhere to that, we'll be able to get through all of the bills today. With that, Representative Elkins is our first bill up today, House File 2028. Representative Elkins, it looks like you have a couple of amendments to your bill. So I'm going to move House File 2228 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Elkins, if you could explain the A1 amendment before we take action on it.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. Yes, the A1 amendment is just improvements in language that was suggested by the staff of the Legislative Coordinating Commission and House Research.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Any discussions to the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any oppose? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. To the A2 amendment, Representative Elkins.
Yes, Madam Chair. So I, once the bill was dropped, I was reached out to by two additional organizations that I think should be at the table, the Building Owners and Managers Association and the Minnesota Chapter of the Community Associations Institute, which is the trade association for the homeowners associations, which have been particularly hard hit by this issue.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Elkins, to your bill is amended.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So we'll try and keep this as tight and quick as we can. If you were around the Twin Cities this weekend, you probably saw this headline in the Star Tribune that says, buildings face 400% spike in insurance. I'm sure everybody around this table has had contacts from their constituents, especially if they're members of a condominium association, which is these 400% price increases on property and casualty insurance have become typical. We all know that the root cause of all this is climate change. It's a nationwide issue. The nature of the issue is different depending on which region of the country you're in. If you're along Florida, the Gulf Coast, it's hurricanes. If you're out west, it's fires. Here, it's hailstorms. We had one hailstorm a few years ago that one storm generated something like $13 billion in hailstorm damage claims. So I had been working on this since last summer, mostly originally at the behest of the homeowners associations in my district who are having extreme difficulties just even getting homeowners insurance. So I've been working on a reinsurance backstop bill. I may still introduce that just for discussion purposes, but it quickly became clear that the problem was broader than just homeowners associations. And in fact, this draft of this bill was first brought to me by representatives of the nonprofit housing industry that have been severely impacted. This issue is impacting both the viability of nonprofit housing providers, and it's one of the several conditions that are contributing to the whole multifamily housing construction market just kind of grinding to a halt right now. So this bill would establish a task force that would meet over the interim to chew up these issues, which are much more complicated than I originally envisioned. And that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And we will first move to testifiers. We have four today. First is Mary Novak and Kevin Pelkey, who are both on Zoom. And then if Julia, Nurban and Paul Egger, if the two of you could just go up to the testifiers table and sit with Representative Elkins so that you'll be ready after the Zoom testifiers finish. So Mary, if you are online, if you could just introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hello, Chair Herr, Chair O'Driscoll, members of the committee. My name is Mary Novak and I'm the Executive Director of Riverton Community Housing. I'm here today to ask you to support House File 2228, and establish a state task force on homeowners and commercial property insurance. Riverton is a housing cooperative organization that believes residents participating in governance of their housing provide a space for collaborative decision-making that ultimately creates stronger communities at a more affordable price. We operate around 600 units of below-market cooperative housing across Minneapolis, and we have served the community for more than 50 years. This housing model offers resources for community problem-solving and resiliency, leadership development, civic engagement, and a building of connections between residents. Right now, Riverton and the entire nonprofit affordable housing field are seeing increases in our insurance costs that outpace any underwriting assumptions. This is impacting Riverton's ability to continue our mission to provide quality, cost-effective housing for our more than 1,300 residents. For example, for our portfolio, we submitted as many as 50 applications to get just one quote with a high premium and deductible with less coverage overall. This has resulted in unsustainable premium growth. In the past 4 years, we have seen premiums increase by 60% when we used to see only single-digit year-over-year increases. We need your support of House File 2228 to establish a statewide task force to examine homeowners and commercial property insurance and hopefully identify solutions to the growing issues faced by housing providers and homeowners. We must take measures now so affordable housing properties stay open and stay affordable. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Novak. If you could just stay on the line in case our members have questions for you. And members, I forgot to announce and testifiers that if you have preferred pronouns you would like for me to use, please do so. Please include that in your introduction of yourself. Our next person to speak is Mr. Kevin Pelkey. And if you could introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Herr and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Pelkey. I'm the Executive Director of Lakes Area Habitat for Humanity, serving Crowing, Cass, Hubbard, and Wadena counties. We are one of 24 local habitat offices across the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 2228 and share our concerns about the rising cost and the decreasing availability of homeowners insurance, particularly as it impacts low-income home buyers and homeowners across Minnesota. Selling homes to families at an affordable price is controllable at the time of sale. For us, we cap that at 25% of income. However, keeping mortgages affordable is more difficult than ever. One of the issues is with homeowners insurance premiums. Renewal statements for homeowners premiums no longer surprise us. In the last 12 to 24 months, premiums have consistently doubled and in some cases tripled. Renewal premiums on simple habitat homes now commonly are outpacing their ability to make their payments with high deductibles. For low-income households, these premiums and these deductibles are not affordable. Of equal concern is that in some locations, finding a carrier willing to write policies is growing more difficult and leaves families with no option but more expensive coverage. One family of ours was dropped for home issues, even though there had been no visit to the property. This homeowner scrambled and finally did find a carrier, but at three times the premium as the carrier who dropped her and with no claims on that policy. Tackling this challenge requires collaboration among policymakers, insurers, housing providers, and other key stakeholders. House File 2228 takes a critical step by creating a task force to convene experts, assess the issues, and develop recommendations to improve insurance affordability. Please support House File 2228. Thank you, Representative Elkins, for championing this legislation, and to MCCD for their leadership. And thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Pelkey. Our next testifier is Julia Nurbin. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you. My name is Julia Nurbin, and I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. And I'd like to thank this committee for taking up House File 2228, which would create this task force to look at the issues affecting homeowners and commercial property insurance in Minnesota. Many of you have probably experienced the hailstorm that happened in August 11th of 2023. And maybe you remember the baseball-sized hail that came down from the sky. And while it only took 25 minutes for that storm to pass through, this turned out to be a $1.8 billion weather event. In the months since then, over half of the houses on my block were awarded a new roof by their insurance companies. People were sort of celebrating this. And yet, no surprise, our premiums steeply went up. In a recently released report by the Consumer Federation of America, Minnesota and the Minneapolis metro area in particular both ranked near the top of regions experiencing diminished affordability and availability of insurance. Minnesota has seen a number of insurers leave our state market in the last couple of years. And we are also seeing coverage reduction and premium increases that outpace inflation as these weather events continue to proliferate. Having insurance is almost always a requirement for receiving a mortgage. You've heard from advocates of the affordable housing market who are concerned. So are we. Making sure that our insurance system is prepared to continue serving Minnesotans, whether they live in cities or rural areas, is critical to the health of our community and to the state, and in fact, to promoting justice across the state. The Consumer Federation of America reports includes a series of policy recommendations, but the very first one is to improve our data collection. So House File 2228 could help Minnesota identify the needed interventions and ensure that we're on a responsible path into the future. So thank you very much for considering this bill. We hope to work with this task force in the future.
Thank you, Ms. Nurban. Next is Paul Egger.
Excuse me, Chair Herr, members of the committee. My name is Paul Egger. I'm Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. We're a business trade association with over 21,000 members, real estate professionals statewide. I want to thank the committee for hearing this bill today. Thank Representative Elkins for all his work on this issue over the past several months. I also want to thank Chair O'Driscoll for the great discussion this committee had a couple of weeks ago on the topic of HOA insurance. I think that was a really good level setting of the challenges that exist in that particular area when it comes to insurance. Over the past couple of years, we've been hearing from more and more of our members about the challenge that both insurance cost and in the case of HOAs, insurance availability is having on the housing market and those trying to get into home ownership. Alongside the challenges of a limited supply and higher mortgage rates, the rising cost of insurance and property taxes is really putting a strain on family budgets and on home ownership. Our research director put together some data that showed the extent to which homeowner budgets are being stretched. And in 2024, the monthly principal interest taxes and insurance PITI payment on a median priced home in Minnesota was $2,551. In 2021, it was $1,622. It's almost a $1,000 increase, or about 57%. That's a huge strain on family budgets, and anything that we can do to try to alleviate some of that stress is going to be helpful. The lack of access to insurance or inadequate coverage can also limit financing available to buyers, particularly where an HOA master policy does not meet Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guidelines. We appreciate the thoughtful approach taken in this legislation to establish this task force, charged with crafting recommendations to strengthen and stabilize homeowners and commercial property insurance industry in Minnesota. We also appreciate the bill identifies Minnesota Realtors as having a representative on the group, and we look forward to participating in the important work that will be undertaken by the task force. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Egger. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify in this bill?
Thank you.
Seeing none, we are going to move to member discussion. Members, any questions for Representative Elkins or the testifiers? Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair Herr. To the author, does the Department of Commerce support this bill?
Representative Elkins.
I believe so, but I haven't spoken with any of them recently. So this would be a legislative initiative under the aegis of the Legislative Coordinating Commission over the summer.
Chair
Davis.
Okay. Any further discussion before I go to Chair O'Driscoll? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Elkins, thank you for bringing this forward. I've received a number of communications from people, not only on multifamily concerns, but also on individual property owners. And I want to underscore what Mr. Ager said, that the cost of housing is affected by a number of different things. And the thing that is eating up people's affordability right now more than anything are property taxes and the cost of homeowners insurance. Yes, interest rates are high, but as market forces change, interest rates can go up and down. Taxes usually don't go up and down, and neither, well, I shouldn't say that. They don't usually go down. They tend to have a propensity to go up, and the same thing with insurance premiums. And so the things that this legislature can do is watch those kinds of issues that can impact an individual's ability to afford and to be able to acquire insurance and keeping an eye on property taxes. You wait till you get your insurance notices this year if you haven't already, and your tax statements, particularly in the Ramsey-Hennepin County area, because there's been a large shift from commercial base, as that's losing value, to the residential base. And so that's going to make housing that much less affordable for persons in the Twin Cities metro area and to a lesser degree in greater Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair O'Driscoll. Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Elkins, any final comments?
It's a good bill. Please vote yes.
Well, we will be laying it over, so it's a good bill. We'll be laying this over. Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Darn.
Our next bill is Representative Ryer's House File 46. And since we just have two testifiers for this, if you could just go up with Representative Ryer as she's getting ready. So Dan Murphy and Ben Wogslin. And I will move Representative Ryer's House 546 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Ryer, there is a amendment, the DE2. If you could just describe that amendment before we take action.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The DE amendment, it simply expands on the original language, making it more clear and understandable, and testimony will be based on the DE2.
Thank you. Any discussions on the DE2? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the DE2 amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Ryer, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Herr and members. House File 46, the Dental Assignment of Benefits Bill, is a consumer-friendly dental insurance bill. It gives plan enrollees the right to request that payment for services they receive be sent directly to the dentist, even if the dentist is out of network. This helps consumers by reducing the amount they have to pay up front for services, rather than paying the full amount and waiting for reimbursement from their dental plan. Assignment benefits also makes life just a little easier by taking out one more set of transactions. One less deposit, payment, and reconciliation to do for medical bills, one less annoyance. This is a voluntary step, so only consumers who want to do this will choose to, and they'll need to request it in writing. It also benefits dentists by reducing the risks of non-payment. With medical debt rising, so many people struggling financially and high levels of debt in general, it's possible that funds received may not, in fact, be sent to settle up that dental bill, not when groceries or rent are at stake. This bill does not change coverage levels. The plan still covers a smaller portion of the charge for an out-of-network dentist. It just changes the administration of the benefit. And to the extent that it makes administration easier for dentists too, it may even serve as an encouragement for those dentists to consider going in-network. Now I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers, and we'll look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Our first testifier is Dan Murphy. Dan, if you could identify yourself for the record and begin.
Co-chairs Herr and O'Driscoll and members of the committee, my name is Dan Murphy with the Minnesota Dental Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill today.
Mr. Murphy, if you could pull your mic forward just so we could hear you a little bit better. Thank you.
Is that better? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill today, which, as Representative Ryer indicated, establishes an assignment of benefit law here in Minnesota. Similar laws exist in over half the states of the United States, but not Minnesota. This bill is about one fundamental principle, giving patients the option to control where their out-of-network dental benefits are sent. This is something that both patients and dentists have requested and seen the need for. When a patient sees an out-of-network dentist, their dental plan often sends reimbursement directly to the patient because the dentist does not have a contract with that plan. Not all plans do that, but some do. This often means that patients, one, pay up front and wait for an unknown period of time for reimbursement to be received. Two, they must navigate complex paperwork and insurance delays. And three, many patients, especially those on fixed incomes, experience financial strain, which can sometimes lead to delayed or forlorn care elsewhere. This bill would also remove these burdens by requiring dental plans to honor the patient's request. And I want to be clear, this bill does not mandate that all out-of-network payments be sent to the dentist, only those that the patient requests. For dental offices, many of which are small businesses, this bill can help reduce administrative costs that are often incurred when attempting to collect a payment from a patient after the service has been provided. For dental plans, this bill can reduce administrative expenses by eliminating the need to issue paper checks to patients who then must turn around and forward that payment to providers. As mentioned already, some insurers already reimburse the rendering provider, but not all do. This bill simply allows the practice to occur for all patients upon request. Allowing patients to assign benefits can help increase patient utilization. By removing financial barriers, patients are more likely to seek necessary treatment, leading to better oral health outcomes, which should appeal to dental plans wanting to have the best for their enrollees. Some insurers may oppose this bill, arguing that it could discourage dentists from joining their network. However, there is a study that analyzed provider networks in at least four states and have found that provider networks have remained strong. And while no study is perfect, this is precedent that provider networks will continue to remain strong. And like I mentioned, over half the states have similar laws and provider networks have been very strong there. In short, House File 46 is a common-sense, patient-centered step that helps enhance access to care, reduces financial burdens, and promotes fairness in dental benefits. If patients are paying premiums for dental insurance and still choose to see an out-of-network provider,
Mr. Murphy, if you could wrap up your testimony.
They deserve to have the right to see where their money goes. Please support this bill today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Up next is Ben Wolgsland. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair O'Driscoll, members of the committee and committee staff. My name is Ben Wogsland. I'm the Vice President of Government Affairs for Delta Dental of Minnesota. I'll keep my comments brief, but I want to start by thanking the author and also Mr. Murphy and the Dental Association for meeting with us and being open to a conversation about our concerns with the bill. There is a written submission in your packets, but I want to just outline a couple of those real quickly. First of all, I want to level set just that from our perspective, networks provide incredible or very important, significant value to both providers and patients in Minnesota. Providers that choose to join a network have access to a higher volume of patients because the plan's patients most often look to in-network providers due to the lower out-of-pocket costs that they're going to see. And in exchange for that, providers agree to accept discounted rates, typically below the list price. Which helps keep out-of-pocket costs down for patients and overall costs down for employer groups purchasing coverage. Providers also get the benefit of accurate and timely claims payments. Today at Delta Dental, we pay 95% of claims within one day, process hundreds of thousands of claims per month with over 99% claims accuracy. Under the current system, out-of-network dentists already have a mechanism to receive compensation. We do not have a direct relationship with out-of-network providers. That relationship is with the patient. The payment goes directly to the patient, and then they can make that portion of the payment to their provider. Very likely, however, they are going to pay additional costs, potentially up to the list price, to that out-of-pocket or out of the out-of-network dentist that are going to be typically higher than an in-network dentist. So we also think that the bill has the potential for a couple of unintended consequences, and I'll wrap this up here, Madam Chair. We think there's a potential for confusion for consumers and a couple other consumer protection limitations that are outlined in the letter. Primarily, we're concerned that if a provider indicates to a patient that they need them to fill out paperwork in order to bill their insurance, we think that there could be the misconception that they are in-network because they're billing insurance directly under this, and that therefore the patient could be confused into thinking they're in-network and not understand that they may be paying higher out-of-pocket costs for that remainder up to the list price that those out-of-network dentists can charge. So I know time is short. I'll leave it there. I'd refer you to our written submission. I, again, want to thank the author for talking with us and agreeing to continue to talk as we go forward in the session. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, are there any members of the public who wish to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member discussions. Members, any questions for Representative West?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I happen to come from a long line of dentists. My father is a dentist. My brother is a dentist. I've never paid for dental care in my life, and I'm very appreciative for that. So I've heard a lot of dinner table conversations about dental insurance, mostly around how it's not really insurance, it's a benefits program. You know, it's very, very different. I think my question is for the representative from Delta Dental. My brother currently operates New Brighton Family Dentistry. Highly recommend you seeing him. He's a great dentist. He says, well, if they come with insurance, we'll figure it out. Doesn't matter who it's from, we'll figure it out and take care of it. So I'm curious, and I've never heard him complain about it not working, eventually anyways, what is the process that a dentist like that goes through? Because he doesn't express any issue with just accepting any dental insurance that comes his way.
Mr. Wogsland.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative West. You know, the majority of providers in Minnesota do decide to be in network. You know, for those that don't, again, the process currently would be we would pay the out-of-network benefit directly to our member, and that they would pay that aspect of the payment that they owe to that provider directly to the provider subsequent to that.
Representative West.
So, just to make sure I'm following this bill, this basically makes it so it goes to the dentist instead of the provider.
Instead of the patient.
That sounds like an improvement from just my experience as son and brother of dentists.
Representative West, is there a question? And I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Well, I'm not even certain. So if he can more specifically explain how, like, it's my understanding that Delta Dental is not thrilled with the bill.
Mr. Wogsland.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative West, I think I understand the question. You're asking for the process. So the process is the payment goes directly to our member, in the enrollee, and they pay the provider. You know, we don't hear concerns about that process. Obviously, you know, the Dental Association and the providers would like that payment to go directly to the provider, and that's where we have the disagreement.
Follow up, Representative West.
Okay. So I was not very good at specifying my question. What's the additional, like, specific burden that could result? I mean, any kind of fiddling with insurance or a benefits program in dental insurance case, the concern is it raises costs for other consumers. Is there a specific aspect of paying the dentist directly that would raise costs for other consumers?
Mr. Wogsland.
Madam Chair, Representative West, that's a good question. I'd have to think about that, not that I can articulate at the moment, but the other challenges as are laid out in the letter, again, out-of-network providers don't go through our credentialing process, which is a consumer protection to our enrollees. This bill would force us into a relationship with a provider that we don't have a contract with, doesn't go through credentialing, maybe a provider that we may have even removed from a network for some reason. And so that's part of the concern. And then secondly, for the patient, if there is some level of confusion about whether it's in-network or out-of-network, that's where we draw the concern or distinction, because they are going to pay, typically, higher costs out-of-pocket when they go to the out-of-network provider. I hope that
any further questions, Representative West, and we're going to move on to Representative Finke. No? Okay, all right, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Herr. I'll keep it very brief. Isn't there a part of the process to avoid confusion when the dentist could tell the patient you're not in network, and thus avoid that confusion?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Finke. Yeah, I think the communication piece is something that we'll talk about more, just to make sure that it's really made clear. But to me, you know, when I think about my experiences with a dentist, I don't think I would know if the out-of-pocket I was paying, if I were in network or out of network, was higher, because my out of pocket when I'm at the dentist is high already. So to me, that's something to be thought about, but it's not a primary concern.
Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Ryer, any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee. I think it's a good bill. I think it's consumer focused. We talked a lot about what do the dentists want and what do the health plans or the dental plans want. I want to always remember that the person who's getting care is at the center of the discussion. So appreciate the support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer, and House File 46 is laid over. Our next bill on the agenda is Representative Mueller's bill, House File 856. Representative Mueller, are you here? Okay. And we do have four testifiers here, and one is on Zoom. If I could actually get Ron Elwood and Patrick Hines, if you could just come up and sit at the table with Representative Mueller, Chair Mueller. And so I will move House File 856 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And there is a DE2, Representative Chair Mueller, if you could just talk through the DE2 amendment before we take action.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The DE2 is the bill. So if you don't mind moving the DE, and then I can talk about it with the bill presentation.
Fantastic. We will go ahead and move the DE2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the DE2 amendment is adopted. Representative Mueller, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And after hearing from the dentist, I'm like paranoid that something's wrong with my teeth right now. So, all right. So this bill, members, Madam Chair and members, really comes from complaints that we've been hearing from our constituents about some issues with homeowners associations over the years. They've expressed frustration in trying to resolve disputes about fines, assessments, and other issues with their HOAs. And often homeowners have no place to turn for help. Part of the problem is that the statute governing HOAs is lengthy, complex, and highly technical. And really, as a result of some of these issues that we've been hearing, we enacted a working group a couple of years ago on common interest communities and homeowners associations. And one of the key areas of discussion of that group was around dispute resolutions. One of the 41 recommendations that they made was the creation of a common interest community ombudsperson. And so that's what this bill does. It creates that ombudsperson. And importantly, that person will help with both homeowners and HOAs. The amendment that you just adopted reflects conversations with and input from the Community Association Institute that represents HOAs. And ultimately, the ombudsperson has two main functions. First, to assist unit owners and associations to understand their rights under the statute and governing documents, and second, to facilitate dispute resolution between unit owners and HOAs. One of the major themes of the work group was creating a space where disputing parties could take the temperature down and stop them from escalating. And another major theme was the gap in knowledge about the basics of the statute, the declaration, and the governing documents. We want people to really better understand all of these documents and their rights. So again, this ombudsperson was a recommendation. I'll note it was a bipartisan working group. It's a bipartisan bill. We've got agreement here, like I said, with this DE. I think some testifiers are going to be in opposition, and I hope that they have read the DE and understand that this is an agreed-upon bill. So that'll be a little perplexing, but I'm anxious to hear from them. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And so our first testifier is Ron Elwood and then Patrick Haynes. We do have someone on Zoom, Becky Cole, if you could just be ready for after our testifiers here are finished. The first is Ron Elwood. If you could identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Herr and Co-Chair O'Driscoll. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 856. Legal Aid was honored to be part of the work group that Representative Mueller referenced. That work group took about 40 hours of testimony from folks across the state. There were hundreds of homeowners and interested stakeholders participating. The work group was a 20-member group, and it represented both homeowners and HOAs. There were 14 meetings over 5 months, and more than 100 suggestions came out of them. And this is one of the most important and dealing with one of the most important issues. We believe that this the establishment of this ombudsperson would go far to take the temperature down on these disputes, which often escalate exponentially, and oftentimes it's over kind of personal personalities and things like that. And we believe that this would be a tremendous benefit to the state, and we are in firm support of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Next is Patrick Hines. If you could identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines from Messerly Kramer. I represent the Community Associations Institute Minnesota chapter, which is a trade organization representing the interests of all those who live and work with homeowner associations. I want to thank Representative Moeller and Mr. Elwood for their hard work on this bill. CAI supports this bill in large part because it starts from the premise that HOAs are not a broken model. We know that there are a lot of complaints that have come up, largely because there are 1.2 million people living in HOAs today and over 8,500 associations. We've heard multiple times about the pressures, the cost pressures of the insurance market being broken, inflation, all of these issues which come down to volunteer board members working with their professional managers to try to do the right thing for the association. So this bill, I think, is important, as Mr. Elwood said, to try to relieve some of the pressure, give residents an opportunity to be heard if they feel like they're not being heard, to give the volunteer board members an opportunity to ask for help if they're struggling to resolve an issue, and to give a neutral third party the opportunity to collect some data and maybe report back to the legislature, tell the legislature what the trends are, what the issues are, and hopefully better inform the legislation that might come out of the legislature in the future. So again, thank you, Representative Moeller. I know there's a cost associated with this. If the HOA issue is important to everyone, I really hope we can find a way to fund this and get it going. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haynes. And on Zoom is Becky Cole. And Becky, before you begin, if I could just get Sandra Weiss to come up to the testifiers table as well. Becky, if you could identify yourself for the record to begin. Ms. Cole, it looks like you are still muted.
Oh, there I am. Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee members. My name is Becky Cole, and I am an HOA homeowner. Having a place to collect data that includes bringing to light the predatory business practices that include bullying, blackmail, misinformation, incomplete information, and lack of transparency, and not a whole lot that recognizes that we as homeowners are footing the bill for those things, would be a great help to homeowners across the state. When I asked our management company where their authority comes from, the response was the bylaws. Perhaps, but it ignores the fact that they were the ones who wrote up the bylaws. They appointed the board, they make the business decisions and have us pay for liability coverage, even though the CCRs say they're supposed to have their own insurance. And these are the things that I would love to see collected with the Office of the Ombudsman that need to be brought together and brought to light. Something else that needs to happen about how the information is posted on the Ombudsman's website. For example, the Attorney General says read the bylaws, but offers nothing to explain that bylaws can be changed on a whim and they don't fit with a statutory definition of a contract. We want homeowners to be empowered, but their conduct and needs to have a place to support that and have a place to go. For example, the choices the board is making to bully a disabled homeowner in Eagan for no other reason than they can is a great example why toxic business practices need to be recorded in a public manner in order for them, the homeowner, to appropriately address the harm. We've been called whiners by CAI, and things like that have been dismissive about homeowners who do make complaints. But we need somebody to call that kind of thing wrong and offer and have some way to defend against it. So I love the idea of having a third-party neutral place to go where we can bring our challenges to somebody who is willing to listen, because that's not currently a process that works well within our current system. If the boards and other places were interested in making better choices, we wouldn't need the legislature to get involved. I have heard from homeowners all over the state, and
Ms.
this
Cole,
is something
if you could
that
wrap
is
up,
important
Ms. Cole,
to
if you
us.
Could wrap up your testimony, please.
Thank you. And it's time for a new industry standard, and this bill will help us get there.
Thank you. Then our last testifier is Sandra Weiss.
Good morning, co-chairs Herron Driscoll. My name is Sandra Weiss. I'm a local restaurateur, mentor, board member, HOA member, advocate, and lifelong Minnesotan. I just became aware of the amendment this morning, so I am flipping. I'm now showing my support for House File 856. The original draft was incredibly vague and concerning to me on many levels. And the recent draft provided clarification that I was asking for every single point I was going to say. So I request support. I'll be brief. I know you have a full day. I just request support for House File 856. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Wise. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at this bill, I just really got to question what this is really going to accomplish. You're going to spend, it looks like, $700,000 every year for this person. I realize this isn't my question. I got several questions, but you've got 1.75 full-time employees. You know, a couple of my questions are wrong. What's this person going to really do? Are you going to take on every complaint that comes to the ombudsman office from individuals? It appears that, you know, I've dealt with associations for a long time. There is this process and a place for people to go. They can go to the... These associations got locally elected board members that they can go to discuss their issues. Often boards hire management companies. There's already a number of places people can go with their concerns. You know, so I don't know if you can answer a couple of those questions and, you know.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Van Binsbergen. As Mr. Elwood said, there were hours upon hours of discussions when they had the working group, and this was a common theme that homeowners didn't feel like they had a place to go. I have personal experience of that with my own father, my mom and dad, and with their homeowners association, with numerous constituents who have reached out to me, and we really think this person can explain what the law is, and particularly with the arbitration process, if there is a dispute, can really help both the homeowners association and that individual homeowner reach an agreement. And again, it was based on a ton of different testimony and recommendations from really across the spectrum of those involved in this.
Representative Van Binsbergen, any follow-up?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just not sure how many cases you think this person's, you know, there's hundreds of homeowners associations out there in Minnesota, and are they going to take on every complaint? You know, every time the phone rings, they're going to pick up the phone, and really, what are they going to be able to accomplish? They're going to have to look in the bylaws, and I just see no clarity and no real avenue other than a spot for people to go and air their complaints.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, but there will be helpful in many ways. Like if a homeowner has a complaint that could be frivolous, the ombudsperson will be able to say, like, here's what the law says, here's what the situation is, and they'll be able to easily resolve that rather than escalating. I know that Mr. Elwood can probably add a little more since he was participating in the working group as well.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Van Binsbergen, there are many ombudspersons around the state in various arenas, and they have been in large part very successful in handling the volume of complaints that come to them. The Office of the Ombudsperson for Long-Term Care, for example, gets many, 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 many complaints and is able to handle them.
The issue here really is that in this setting, HOAs are sort of these quasi-governmental entities with all the power of a government and no oversight whatsoever, which is the way it's set up, and that's all well and good, but that engenders distrust in many cases between the homeowner and the HOA. The management company, as you point out, if they have one, is certainly available to work on these complaints, but the management company works with the HOA. So there's really no independent, objective third party where people can go, and that has been the major theme of one of the major themes of this work group, that there's just no place for people to go. I'm going back to the same person who told me no in the first place. And so this is an opportunity. If you notice, the bill requires some plain language translation, if you will, of some of these complex laws and bylaws. The idea would be if somebody comes to the ombudsperson and they have a non-meritorious complaint, the ombudsperson can say, hey, look, you know, the law's not with you, so let's just go, you know, move on. And if there's a meritorious complaint, then potentially they can work this out without having people having to go to court and having temperatures rise, which happen frequently.
One last follow-up, Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, there is a spot for them to go. They can go to their local board members that they elect. Every association's got a group of local people that they elect, and I guess if they don't like the answers they're getting, they can elect somebody else on that board. So, just a final comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt, if we can be concise with our questions, because we have two other people after.
Got it. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mueller. I don't mean to rebuttal my good friend across the aisle there, but I'm going to have to because I'm involved in this mess as a realtor and as a state rep. People have nowhere to go in this state. There are multiple agencies that handle these little things, and they get lost, and these people get frustrated. The testifier was real clear on this. I get bullied. All of a sudden, my house is in foreclosure. Thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this to us. I just signed on to the bill. It's a great bill. I hope we can do something, because right now we're not doing much.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. We'll go to Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Mueller, for bringing this bill and working on it and improving it drastically. Like, it's a lot of work on a lot of bills, and you're a chair, so I commend you for that. I share Representative Van Binsbergen's concerns of just sheer volume. Not exactly excited about dumping a ton of money into this because we have a deficit going forward. There's some concern on volume, but in my experience, my question's around sub-associations and master associations. So I lived in a sub-association that I've since escaped its tyranny, but the sub-association, the 2017 hailstorm, we wanted, as a sub-association, to use a particular contractor. The master association said, if you use that contractor, we're going to charge you a 10% fee. They said, you have to use this contractor. They happen to own that other contractor. So those are the concerns that have created a tremendous amount of animosity for me and why I like this bill. But I'm curious, how would this also deal with the interaction between homeowner associations, not just the homeowners, but the sub and master associations?
Chair Mueller, Representative Ron Elwood, please. I promoted you.
Thank you for the promotion, Madam Chair, and Representative West. This is really would be between the homeowner and the association. So if I understood your question, it would be the master associations or the declarants. It would only be once the association is formed and there's a problem between the board and the homeowner.
Any follow-up, Representative West? Thank you. And we'll go to our last member question, Co-Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mueller, thank you for your work on this. I am a big supporter of homeowners associations because what it does is it takes a lot of pressure off of the local units of government where there's folks who are in patio home developments, townhome developments, condominium developments, and it allows them to manage that internally. And the thing that's important to remember is the homeowners association, the Homeowners Association is the owners of units within that property. And they have a free right, as Representative Van Spinbergen said, to run for the board, to be elected, to just like they elect their state representatives. And if they don't like the job that their state representative is doing, they can choose to, you know, go in a different direction if they want. What I think that we have as a problem, and we've identified this in previous committees, and Mr. Cocking, I think, hit on it a few weeks ago, is and Representative West again this morning, is that we have issues with ownership of management companies and sub-companies that they have that are having tying agreements that are going in and doing work, and the associations may not be getting the best pricing for those kinds of things. That is something that will not only help in this discussion, but the Elkins discussion from earlier today as well. And the last thing I would like to offer is, when you become a legislator or a county commissioner or a school board member or a city council member or a township board member, and the list goes on, the associations that those cities and communities belong to offer training to individuals who are going to assume those roles. And if we want to help homeowners to and homeowner associations to function at a higher level, perhaps we should find ways to encourage training of people who are going to hold offices in those particular homeowners associations so they know what's happening. My experience has been no one really wants those jobs, and sometimes people don't run, and the board has to appoint people and convince people to get on the board for a lot of the reasons that were discussed today. Homeowners come to the board with questions, come to the board with problems. So it's not just the ombudsman. There are multiple things that we can address here. And I just have one quick question for Chair Mueller, if I might. Does this in any way affect Taylor Swift?
Chair Mueller.
I was listening to Taylor Swift this morning in the car on the way here, and Champagne Problems was what I was listening to today, but this is not a champagne problem. This is a problem for many Minnesotans.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, Chair Mueller, any wrap-up?
Yeah, thank you, co-chairs. Appreciate the discussion. I will just say, you know, some of the complaints that we've heard about are homeowners have gone to their boards, and some of these, I'm not saying all of them, boards are very beholden to the very powerful management companies. And there are other bills moving that are trying to address some of the David and Goliath way that these laws are written. They are having trouble, some of these homeowners, even talking to other members of their associations because of the way things are structured. And again, it is very kind of like a David and Goliath situation. There clearly is a problem based not only from what we're hearing in the legislature from our constituents, but also as was reflected in the working group. And again, I'll say there are other bills, including one that has a different perhaps pay structure for being able to pay for this, because we understand that's always a difficult conversation when we're asking funding from the general fund. And hopefully this committee can get to support. Thank you again for the opportunity to present.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and House File 856 is laid over. All right, members. Our second to last bill for the day today is Representative Greenman's bill, House File 2149. And we do have a number of testifiers for this, and so we're going to try to move through getting the amendment adopted. I will move House File 2149 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And Representative Greenman, there is an A1 amendment. Could you discuss the amendment before we take action?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment simply corrects typos.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Greenman, your bill is amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's nice to be here in Commerce this morning. This is a bill that's about leveling the playing field to create fair markets for Minnesota small, medium, and independent grocery businesses. Small and medium independent grocers are the backbone of our food economy, and local groceries that feed Minnesotans in all of our districts, districts like mine, districts like Representative Schultz, who's here with me, and districts like all of yours. But like so many other places in our economy, in the food market in the last few decades, there's been a huge amount of consolidation that has driven out small and local grocers. While the biggest companies get bigger and use their market power and dominance in anti-competitive ways to further consolidate and squeeze out the small competitors. In the interest of time, I'm going to leave to both Representative Schultz and to some of our testifiers to really get into the nuts and bolts of the bill. But it is just to say there's a reason why there's bipartisan consensus that this problem is a real problem. We're all seeing it. We're hearing from it from voters. The biggest companies get bigger, they use their market power to squeeze the little guys, and that's what this bill is about.
Thank you, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Greenman. I just want to tell a quick story about rural Minnesota today, and you know, a big section of the state that I represent. And in my own hometown communities and across all of the small towns in my area, there used to be family, small business, grocery stores. And that's not the environment today. And while I still am blessed to have grocery stores in the immediate two neighboring towns from where I live, that which is found on the shelves of those same grocery stores is so limited compared to the challenges, compared to the, frankly, the big box store settings that have risen across our state, which has been a major challenge that ultimately cuts at the heart of some of the challenges that we deal with on antitrust and competition, which is why we're here today. And I want to be very clear with you right now. I believe in competition. I believe in transparency, and I believe that this legislature should have this conversation. And I just appreciate the chance for us to have this bill before you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Our first two testifiers are online, but if I could have Jessica Roloff come up to the testifiers table as well, and then Zachary Page to be on deck. The first testifier online is Chris Jones. If you could identify yourself for the record and begin.
Good morning, Chair Herr and members of the committee. My name is Chris Jones, and I am the head of government relations at the National Grocers Association, which represents independent supermarkets and the wholesalers that service them across this country. In Minnesota, our members operate around 460 grocery storefronts and support over 47,000 jobs and contributing more than $380 million in annual state taxes. I'm honored to speak in support of the Consumer Grocery Pricing Fairness Act, introduced by Representatives Greenman and Schultz. The bill addresses a serious and growing problem, the abuse of market power by dominant national grocery chains, enabled by decades of weak antitrust enforcement at both the state and federal levels. Today, just four national retailers control nearly 70% of all U.S. grocery sales. These companies have grown so large that they can dictate terms to suppliers and agriculture producers, leaving independent grocers to pay higher wholesale prices and what consumers pay than what consumers pay at those dominant chains. This distorted dynamic is creating three major harms. Number one, consumers pay more, especially in areas where competition is lacking. Number two, food deserts are expanding as independent grocers cannot compete and are forced to close in rural and underserved communities. Number three, farmers and ranchers are losing their bargaining power with fewer buyers for their goods. The Consumer Grocery Pricing Fairness Act is a targeted, reasonable measure that only creates new obligations for dominant suppliers and retailers, those who have real market power. Contrary to what some in the business community have falsely claimed, it protects legitimate volume discounts while preventing discriminatory pricing that undermines the competitive process. We urge your support for this legislation on behalf of consumers, grocers, food workers, and producers across Minnesota. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Next is Ron Knox. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ron Knox. I'm a senior researcher and advocate at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, a Minnesota-based nonprofit where I study corporate concentration and monopoly power. I use he/him pronouns. I've seen it suggested that HF 2149 will somehow make groceries more expensive for shoppers in Minnesota. If lawmakers want to witness an economy in which grocery prices are sky high and getting higher by the day, they can simply look at the supermarket industry right now, where corporate dominance and concentration are the norm, where corporate profits are skyrocketing, and many shoppers struggle to afford a cart full of groceries. For many decades in America, we knew that the secret to maintaining low prices, high innovation, and strong self-reliant communities was a vibrant and diverse grocery industry fostered by our insistence on fair competition in our marketplaces. We insisted on this fairness in large part by banning price discrimination, where powerful retailers bully suppliers into giving them low prices while forcing smaller stores to pay more for the same goods. When the federal government stopped enforcing our federal law against price discrimination 40 years ago, the concentration of our retail economy really began. And today, Walmart accounts for $1 in every $4 spent on groceries in America, while the number of small retailers is half of what it was in 1980. Shoppers today struggle to afford basic necessities, yet as a Federal Trade Commission study has recently found, corporate profits among supermarket chains are higher today than they have been in many, many years. And we know that price discrimination lies at the root of this particular evil. Enacting HF 2149 would enshrine protection from price discrimination in Minnesota law. It would help Minnesota's independent grocers compete on fair terms and would preserve the competition needed to keep prices low, all while helping farmers and small manufacturers find more markets for the things that they grow and make. The bill would also close two key loopholes.
Mr. Knox, if you could wrap up your testimony, please.
Sure. The bill would also close two key loopholes that powerful retailers and consumer goods companies use. I want to thank Representatives Greenman and Schultz for bringing the bill forward. I urge lawmakers to pass this crucial piece of legislation, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knox, and my apologies for cutting people off. I just want to make sure we get through member questions as well. Up next is Jessica Roloff, and if Zachary Page, if you could also come up to take the other seat. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Hello, my name is Jessica Roloff, and I am a member of the Minnesota Farmers Union. I also am the manager of the New London Food Co-op. We just celebrated being able to stay in business 1 year. I'm from New London. I'm born, raised, have lived there. I'm a proud farm kid. We had 4 to 5 grocery stores to choose from in the local communities. When I was a kid, we went 15 years in New London without a grocery store. It took 6 years of planning by community volunteers, fundraising, remodeling a 100-year-old building. We currently use 50% labor. And we're not asking for 50% of our labor is volunteer. We're not asking for favors. We're not asking for charity, but we're asking for fairness and transparency. When I get a wholesale order list, the prices are often 27 to 97% above the shelf price of the big box retailers. Now, why should you support us? Well, we serve our community. We are a place where the senior citizens come. We are a place where our disabled community members come. We have 300-plus member households that depend on us. What we were met with after we opened, we developed 30 local producer-to-store partnerships. We're really proud of that. But I can't bring everything in directly from my community. And what we were met with when we opened is non-responses for wholesale applications. We're met with NDAs, exclusivity contracts. It's just simply not fair. And it's not just rural Minnesota. It is any place where there are small grocery stores. And those small businesses often serve the least served communities. We're building something important where I live, but we need some sunshine on how these systems operate. Even among co-ops, we'll have the same minimum order. A co-op will be 10 miles from the next co-op. They'll be on the same truck route, and they're offered different pricing lists, and there's no explanation. How can this be fair? How can we stay in business? I'm very proud of the fact that I still live on my grandparents' farm. We're going to grow wheat this year. Now, how will my wheat ever be able to enter my store? This is the question I have. It is less expensive for me to order from Italy than it is to get either General Mills products or Cremette products in my store. How can this be a system that is based on fairness, transparency, and in the best interest of consumers. I want to end it with one final thing, that the woman who walked down to my store, who's a senior in the committee, in the community, and cried because I had a fresh peach for sale, because she said she didn't know if she'd ever get to taste a fresh peach again in her life. That's what this means. It's not asking for fancy things. It's just asking to be included in some basic things that everybody should be able to access, and that is good food at fair prices, and to not have our small communities decimated. And so I really want to thank Representative Greenman and Representative Schultz for bringing this conversation to the table. It is so important, and I'll tell you, many small businesses are afraid to speak up because they are very worried that at any minute they could be pulled from the route and then have no supplier. And you can simply cannot afford
Ms. Roloff, if you could wrap up your testimony.
Yes, and you simply cannot afford to be cut off from suppliers. And so I'm here to speak for all of us, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next is Steve Barthel, and if I could have Michelle Benson come up as well. Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Good morning, Chair Herr and Chair O'Driscoll and members of the committee. My name is Steve Bartle. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Grocers Association. For over 125 years, the MGA has been the leading voice of Minnesota's food industry. Our membership represents over 300 member companies, including retailers, producers, manufacturers, brokers, wholesalers. Together, the MGA employs operates over 1,300 locations and employs over 150,000 workers. We would like to express our appreciation to Representative Greenman and Representative Schultz for their leadership in recognizing the challenges of independent retailers and for looking for ways to address these issues. House File 2149 would strengthen business protections for local retailers, ensuring all businesses are operating on a level playing field and providing state regulatory enforcement for existing federal law. Minnesota has a vibrant culture of independent, multi-generational, and locally owned grocery and convenience stores. In fact, Minnesota ranks among the top 15 states in the nation for market share held by independent grocery retailers. Another fun fact, Minnesota is the only state in the country without either an Albertsons or Kroger store. This is a direct result of the strong, locally engaged independent retailers who continue to support their communities. Independent retailers are facing significant challenges: market consolidation, difficulties with product sourcing, as well as workforce shortages. In addition, our customers are facing the threat of higher prices as a result of government policies. Whether it's higher tariffs at the federal level or increased employer mandates at the state level, these policies drive up costs and make products more expensive for Minnesota consumers. Understanding these challenges, we support the goals of House File 2149. We are committed to continuing the work to work with all stakeholders to find solutions that will foster a marketplace where independent retailers can thrive. We believe this proposal requires careful, thorough examination and input from all sectors of the industry. We are in favor of a measured, thoughtful approach. To use the old adage, measure twice, cut once. We are hopeful that through continued discussion and collaboration, we will arrive at a solution that will provide meaningful protection for independent retailers. Thank you to the committee for your time. And thank you to Representative Greenman and Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Barthel. Next is Michelle Benson, and after her will be Tim Wilkins. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chair Herr, members of the committee, Representatives Greenman and Schultz. On behalf of the 6,300 members of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, representing all sizes of businesses and industries across the state, and their over 500,000 employees, we respectfully oppose House File 2149. Costs matter to Minnesota businesses and families. We understand and support efforts to lower everyday costs of energy, housing, and food. This is why we support fair, open, and competitive private sector markets. Competition drives the best deals for consumers and forces innovation and efficiencies for the providers of goods and services. Enforcement of current state and federal antitrust law helps ensure fair competition, and one of the tenets of these antitrust laws is the protection of competition, not competitors. This competition ultimately benefits consumers, and it is that benefit to consumers that we should be looking for in this proposal. House File 2149 raises a number of questions. In Section 3, Subdivision 1, Paragraph 2, a covered retailer can ask for contract terms for the sale of a dominant retailer. What about the long-held business standard that contracts are private, that you cannot be compelled to share trade secret and proprietary information? Collaboration of contract terms is by its nature anti-competitive, and under this structure, the price of goods could converge to a single point, eliminating price competition and leaving consumers with no opportunity to seek a different purchase price for the same good. When consumers seek differentiated prices, a valuable signal is sent to the market about the worth of the good or service. Could a covered retailer seek contract disclosure from a dominant retailer that is outside an economically relevant market? Could a covered retailer in Wyndham be able to ask for a contract that applies to a dominant covered retailer in Duluth? These two entities would not be in competition with each other, but it appears this bill would allow that request. Is it the author's intention to put a geographic limitation on actions and remedies? I think this would be a good question to answer as this language goes forward. Can a covered retailer ask for terms given to a dominant retailer that operates online but delivers to a geographically relevant market or simply to the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Benson, if you could wrap up your testimony, please.
Thank you. We have deep concerns over the state moving forward in antitrust law that is largely managed at the federal level. This would be first of its kind language, untested in other states, unchallenged in the courts, and it would make Minnesota an outlier. This is complicated, and Minnesota should not go beyond federal law or become a legal outlier on this issue. We thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, and Representatives Greenman and Schultz for consideration of our comments and concerns.
Thank you. Up next is Tim Wilkins, and if Bruce Newstead could also come up to the testifiers table. Tim, if you could identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Tim Wilkin. I'm the president of the Minnesota Beverage Association. We're the makers and distributors of non-alcoholic beverages in Minnesota and primarily family-owned businesses. I'm here today to express our opposition. While the bill is well-intended, it won't benefit consumers and retailers. Once you understand how distribution and pricing work, you'll understand why. Large retailers often use an everyday low price model. Their businesses offer a year-round low price, their low margin and high volume. They get steady prices from us. We drop off the product and they stock the shelves. Very different from the small retailers who tend to run sales. You'll see they're advertising, they got a two-week sale on a given product, and we support them with special pricing. Often that special pricing is actually lower than what the big box stores get. Their service is a little different though. We stock their shelves. We set up the displays, the end caps, we provide the printed material for these merchants. They tend to be a higher margin and low volume business model. We value both, and we need both to be healthy and financially thriving because we don't want to be subject to the dominant retailers either. This legislation, though, could produce inadvertent violations by our members because you have employees working in the different channels. And those within those different channels, one might be working on the high volume businesses and another might be working on the smaller retailers. And they might not know what deals they're giving to each other. We'd have to add a layer of attorneys to review compliance, and that will only add to the cost of consumers. We're also concerned about the disclosure of contract terms. While it says anonymized, our members have limited distribution areas, and it'd be pretty easy to figure out who's getting what in that. And that's not healthy for retail competition, and it's not healthy for competition among my members. We're also concerned about
Mr. Wilkins, if you could wrap up your testimony, please.
Yes, I will. We're also concerned about the need to add a lot of paperwork to justify what the different deals are, and also the private right of action that could bring more litigation to our members. So we ask you to oppose this legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkins. And our last testifier who signed up ahead of time was Bruce Newstead. If you can identify yourself for the record and begin.
Hi, good morning, Chair Hearn, Chair O'Driscoll, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Newstead with Minnesota Retailers. I represent about 1,200 storefronts across the state, from family-run Main Street retailers to national brands. Together, we're really focused on keeping Minnesota competitive and making sure products are accessible for Minnesota families. Thank you to Representative Greenman for the conversation on this bill yesterday, and I will say this is a well-intentioned bill, but it is fundamentally flawed, and in our opinion, if it's passed, it would actually have possibly the opposite effect of what the title suggests. It won't create grocery price fairness. It'll drive up food costs. That'll hurt Minnesota families and hurt the competitiveness of local businesses and potentially put the state in conflict with federal law. Retail pricing, including grocery pricing and covered consumer packaged goods that are covered in this bill, are competitive because retailers negotiate different terms based on their size, their efficiency, their supply chain, their distance from suppliers, et cetera. That's really how the free market works, and this competition actually helps keep prices down. This bill would force suppliers to offer identical pricing and contract terms to all retailers, no matter what their different business models are. On paper, that might sound like fairness, but in practice, it really strips away the flexibility that helps local businesses compete and keeps products affordable. And there's a little bit of an irony that this bill could actually hurt the small retailers that it's trying to help. Many local stores, actually, as you heard this morning, already get special pricing and access to strong relationships to suppliers close to them or that they've negotiated great relationships with. And this could enter into a conflict with those special pricing or those special deals that those retailers get. In some cases, small retailers do get better pricing than larger retailers because of their agility or their group buying participation, and House File 2149 would take that away. That's really not fairness. That's a uniform model that drives up price across the board. House File 2149 also opens the door to supply chain issues. It would require suppliers to disclose, as you've heard, confidential contracts and pricing strategies, something that's really not only bad for business but potentially illegal under federal law. The Robinson-Patman Act already addresses price discrimination, but only when it harms competition. This bill strips that away entirely. Equally concerning is the bill would push Minnesotans, possibly in direct conflict with federal law, again, back to the Robinson-Patman Act. That law regulates price discrimination, but that law only kicks in when there's actual harm to competition versus and a real injury versus a price difference that's included in this bill. Federal law also recognizes that suppliers can treat retailers differently.
Mr. Newstead, if you could wrap up your testimony.
Madam Chair, thanks for the time today. I appreciate it. Our goal is really to support small business and lower grocery prices. Let's look for better ways, including flexibility, tax relief for small businesses, regulatory reform, and reduced mandates. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Newstead. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. First on the list is Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair Hearn, and thank you for Representative Schultz and agreement for bringing this forward. I understand the merit of this bill, and it's very important to communities like mine as being a new American. You know, grocery stores that you're describing serves communities like mine, especially when, you know, my father and my mother, they don't have a vehicle for transportation. So they rely heavily on the local markets and local grocery store. And of course, being Asian, there's particular items that we need for our staple diet and stuff like that. And so thank you for bringing this bill forward. And it truly is about local small business and servicing our underserved community. So thank you. Appreciate that to both of you.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Echoing the sentiment of Representative Cha, thank you for the bill. I just wanted to quickly reflect on something, and then I have a question for the bill author. One of the things I think is interesting about being on Commerce is we have a lot of lobbyists telling us how well-intentioned our bills are, but how we really can't change anything. We shouldn't change anything, but you're trying to do something good. And I actually think, you know, the price of groceries is like the biggest story in the entire country. We are having arguments at every single level of government about how people cannot afford food. And this seems to me to be an actual attempt to try to help people afford food. So thank you for doing that. And, you know, in my community, we have Tim and Tom's, which is a great local hub, a local grocer. It's been there for 50 years or whatever. A lot of kids go there after school. They know everybody. It's just a real hallmark of the district that I serve in St. Paul. And, you know, when we hear that these things are going to do I mean, I would like to hear basically what is your response to what you heard from the chamber? What is your response to these arguments that we're hearing that this is not going to help these businesses live but actually harm them?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke. And I appreciate the framework because our current very lightly regulated system is not keeping prices down for people. And what this is doing is saying what we're dealing with is the anti-competitive behavior of the biggest, most concentrated, dominant players who are using their dominance in the market to force often unwillingly, to bully and force better prices that small businesses don't get. All this says, and it protects provisions for true efficiencies, but all this bill says is that small businesses who can buy by the same quantity, by the truckload, should get access to the same prices that the biggest, most dominant businesses. And I'll say that there's thresholds in this bill. $18 billion of sales is not even many of our bigger grocery stores, right? That is the biggest dominant market share. So that's what the aim is, and that's why we think it'll do the work.
Any follow-up, Representative Finke? Thank you. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman, for bringing this bill. You almost covered my question. I have two questions. One, 2.14 to 2.19 defines the dominant retailer. $18 billion, a presence in over 20 states or 20 or more states. Which retailers does that cover? It sounds like it's a very small number. And I'm curious, particularly does it include Amazon? Because I'm not sure if they have a retail location in 20 plus states.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I might have to defer this to our friends at the National Grocers. What I will say is, as we heard, 1 in 4 grocery dollars are Walmart, so it includes Walmart. I do believe it also includes Amazon, who owns Whole Foods. I know they don't have a big grocery footprint on their own, but I believe it owns Whole Foods, Albertsons, and Kroger's. And if I can either get you a full list from Chris or I can take it offline, whatever the chair wants me to. But there is that list that we can provide.
If your testifier who could answer that could come up in case there's further questions for them. Representative West, did you want follow-up on that, or would you like to take that offline?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it would be interesting to see a list. Obviously, you don't need to sum it up right now. I think this is just getting laid over, so we don't need to really go all the way. I was shocked to see Representative Schultz up there, I'll be honest, what you put in his water. After hearing some, I was initially very opposed to the bill. I'm open to learning more, and that's why I'm curious who all does it affect. But there is one problem I see with the bill that would be required for my support anyways. I know you just dream of it every day, but on lines 5.27, it says if somebody's harmed, they can bring action, but it also says the Attorney General can bring right action, which I have significant concerns with, just because, well, one, that's a partisan office, which can distort what they do on occasion, and how are they really going to know who and what was damaged? I mean, they could, like, there's a complaint process, but what those people who should do the complaints should just bring the suits themselves, because they have standing because they were damaged. So that is more of a comment. If we just struck the AG as being able to bring a case and kept it to those who are damaged, I think that would drastically improve the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you mind if I respond?
Just a quick response, and then Representative Greenman, if you want to just incorporate that into your closing comments. Mr. Jones.
Yeah, just quickly, we only think the bill would touch about 10 or so total national retailers across the country. Amazon would be one of them. They're upwards of $60 billion in sales. And to your point about the AG, I think, you know, the way that we look at the bill is it's very narrow. The conduct is very specific. The definitions are very specific. So there would not be a lot of latitude for a political AG to use this as a means to achieving some other objective than what the underlying bill says. Most of the federal antitrust and state antitrust statutes are broad, but I think this is intention to be specific to avoid that kind of challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. And then Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill forward. I think I understand the heart of it. I do think it misses the mark a little bit. And my question is, you know, a supplier-retailer relationship can change for any legitimate business reason. I think a bill like this would create a legitimate business reason anytime you have legislation that tries to control pricing. Often what happens is you have business relationships that are just dropped completely. And my question for you is there any recourse or is there any thought given to the fact that there's such volume in these retail relationships that it might not even be worth it for a bill like this for the supplier to continue the relationship with the smaller retailer? Have you had any discussions about the potential implications about these suppliers just completely cutting off smaller retailers in response to a bill like this?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Reimer. What I think you heard you say is that there are small, very small grocers who are already worried about arbitrarily not getting access to products in the market. And so I'm not worried that this bill will add to that. What this bill is about is not regulating prices. It's about regulating price discrimination. It's about saying if you are the smallest, if you're, frankly, most of our grocery retails that are in our communities, that you will have access to the same prices and pricing terms that the biggest companies can use their power to get.
Any follow-up, Representative Reimer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One follow-up on that real quick is, are there any other industries where volume-based pricing is pricing discrimination?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Reimer. This protects, actually, quantities and efficiencies. But the Robinson-Patman Act, which you heard referred to, is a federal law that deals with price discrimination in a much broader way across the economy. The reason that this is tailored to groceries, as you heard, what we're trying to do is solve a very specific problem with much more narrow tools than across the economy dealing with price discrimination.
Any further follow-up, Representative Reimer?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. We're seeing no further discussion. Representative Greenman, any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know you're on a time and keeping it brief. One of the things that Representative Schultz and I have been talking to as we talk to the Minnesota Grocers, the Minnesota Farmers Union, UFCW, and many others, I've had lots of conversations with the lobbyists here you'll hear today, is there's a lot of things we can do to right-size this bill, to think about what it covers and who it covers, but this is a problem. 70% of the market is controlled by four dominant retailers. That's getting worse, and in Minnesota, we need to protect the local storefront businesses. This is a bill that will do protect our groceries, as you heard from our grocer here today.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. And House File 2149 is laid over. Our last bill on the agenda today is for Representative Holland's bill, House File 2215. And as she makes her way up to the testifiers table, I will move House File 2215 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And if we could also have two of her testifiers come up to the testifiers table so that we can eliminate some of that transition time. Representative Hollins, it looks like you have one amendment to your bill. If you could share a little bit about what that amendment is before we take action.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. This one amendment is just a clarification, adding the word commerce to commissioner to make sure it's very clear which commissioner does the work.
Members, any discussion to the A1? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hollins, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Thank you, committee members. I'm here today to advocate for House File 2215, a state-run low-cost auto insurance program, which is a solution that will provide significant benefits to drivers across the state. I want to really quickly highlight three reasons why I feel this bill is important. The first is that for many individuals and families, car insurance premiums can be an insurmountable financial burden and one that cannot be avoided as it's the only form of insurance that is required by the state. Not having it is punishable by a criminal penalty. Driving without a license, with that insurance rather, can result in a $280 ticket, mandatory license revocation, possible vehicle impoundment, and a misdemeanor charge. Secondly, we know that private insurance companies determine the cost of their premiums using a variety of measures, including zip codes and credit scores. In fact, where you live and how much money you make can potentially have a bigger impact on what you pay for your car insurance than your actual driving record. And third, uninsured drivers are a hazard to all Minnesotans. Reducing the number of uninsured drivers on the road is good for everybody. It creates safer roads for all drivers, and fewer tickets for uninsured driving reduces the burden on police, courts, and families. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Our first testifier is Anna Odegaard. If you could identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the Midwest Regional Director for the Fines and Fees Justice Center. The Lifeline program established in House File 2215 is modeled on low-cost auto insurance programs in other states that sell affordable insurance to safe drivers who can't afford insurance on the commercial market. The program is funded by premiums paid by participants, and it's administered by the Minnesota Auto Insurance Plan. Premium rates for the program are approved by the Department of Commerce, just like rates in the commercial market, and have to meet the same actuarial standards. A Lifeline policy meets Minnesota coverage requirements for bodily injury liability, property damage liability, and uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. A Lifeline policy does not include comp and collision, voluntary coverages that are not required by law. Lifeline isn't a subsidized program. Participants pay the full premium cost for their insurance policy, but it's less expensive than the commercial market for four factors. In the Lifeline program, people won't be penalized for non-driving factors like a low credit score, a low-income zip code, or being unmarried, all of which drive up your rates in the commercial market. You have to meet a good driver standard to participate, so it's a low-risk pool, which keeps rates down for everyone. The program would be facilitated in the same way and by the same facility as the existing residual market, which doesn't have a profit component, so that keeps prices down too. And last, Minnesota is one of the few remaining states that require people to buy health insurance as part of their auto insurance policy. It's called Personal Injury Protection, or PIP for short. 41 states don't require drivers to purchase PIP, but Minnesota still does, and it's expensive. PIP accounts for about a third of the premium cost of a minimum limits policy. And in the Lifeline program, drivers whose household members all have comprehensive medical insurance can opt out of buying this additional medical coverage, and that brings premiums down significantly. Taken together, these factors make it possible for the Lifeline program to sell a much lower cost, public safety focused policy. By making it possible for those drivers to comply with the law, it also lowers uninsured driving rates in Minnesota. More insured drivers paying into the system, maintaining liability insurance, means safer roads and lower premiums for everyone. Thank you for considering this bill.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Ma Elena Gutierrez. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Yes, good morning, everyone. My name is Ma Elena Gutierrez, Executive Director of Fe Justicia, a grassroots Latinx faith-based organization. We strive to bring justice, kindness, and compassion to our community in Central Minnesota. We organize and listen to the stories in our community, working class community. For example, Mariana lives in a small town and works at a cheese company. She constantly talks to me about where she can get car insurance. She says, I finally passed my acknowledge and driver license test. I saved money and was able to buy my car. The problem is that car insurance cost me $247 a month, and with the money I earn, it is not enough to pay rent, food, and all other household expenses. I don't make much money, and I am a single mother. I want to be able to drive my car without fear of being stopped by the police and getting a ticket for not having insurance. If I drive like that, they will end up canceling my license, and one problem causes another problem. As an immigrant, I want to do what is right for me and my family. I live 5 blocks away from my job, and I keep walking to my work in freezing temperatures. I need insurance so I can go to buy my groceries in St. Cloud. Like Mariana, there is many more single parents who only have one income in the household and need to be able to pay all their household expenses. They are looking for affordable car insurance to meet the car requirements. Please support Bill HF 2215. Thank you.
Our next testifier is Kendra Gagner, and if we can also have Travis Matthews come up to the testifier's table. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to be here. My name is Kendra Gagner. I work currently employed by Comcast, but I am also the chair of the CAPRW Head Start program here in Ramsey County. To have a bill that would allow everyone to be insured at an affordable rate would be phenomenal. Being a single parent of 3 children, 1, 18, 13, and 3, and having to pay a high amount of auto insurance has been a burden for me and my family. When my son turned 15, trying to show him the right way to live and put him through driver's education, at 16, he received his driver's license. In June, I received my insurance renewal where I was excited because I had made that 3-year no moving violations and was excited for my insurance premium to go down. However, instead, my premium went from $216 a month to $518 a month. Upon researching and contacting my insurance company, they explained to me that because there are two licensed drivers registered at my residence, therefore my premium would be increased. When I asked them where in my policy it stated that they could do this, they told me there wasn't. This was kind of an umbrella rule. Everybody in the house as licensed needed to have insurance. I was able to negotiate with them, and I now pay $418 a month instead of $518. It's a little over $5,000 a year. With this increase out of my control, it has for sure put me and my family in a financial burden where my other bills, where I was just managing by, is not as possible. To have to make a choice on whether to pay my insurance or to pay for groceries and other necessities for my family, including rent and other utilities, or to be unlawful without insurance was a huge burden that to this day I am still trying to figure out. I think that this bill, having affordable insurance, would help people like myself and many others to be able to maintain the daily life of bills, all while remaining law-abiding, and this is a plus for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gagner? Gagne? Thank you. Sorry about that. Next is Travis Matthews, and if we could also have Katia Zapeta up at the table. And please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. I'll be quick, I promise. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Travis Matthews, and I'm the Foster Post-Secondary Coordinator at Youth Prize. This bill addresses an issue that directly impacts thousands of people across Minnesota, including many of the young people we have the privilege of working with at Youth Prize, access to affordable auto insurance. Insurance rates for young people under the age of 24, and especially opportunity youth, including youth experiencing homelessness, young parents, current and former fosters, young people in the justice system, and young people out of school and out of work aligned to a workforce program are not well tracked, but some estimates suggest that in Minnesota, drivers under the age of 24 make up nearly 8% of all licensed drivers, but account for over 13% of vehicular crashes. This just isn't because they lack experience. It's also because they face real structural barriers to obtaining their driver's license and then subsequently getting insured and staying covered. Some young people, like many of the participants in the ETV program I work with, don't have an adult in their life who can help them get a car registered, provide guidance on how insurance works, or advocate for them if something goes wrong. Opportunity youth, those who are disconnected from both work and school, face even greater obstacles. Without stable employment, they may have no way to afford coverage at all, leaving them with an impossible choice: stop driving and lose access to jobs, education, and daily necessities, or take the risk of driving uninsured. And the reality is, many of those young people will drive whether they have insurance or not. A little over a year ago, during my senior year of college, I personally faced the challenge of finding car insurance coverage, and the quotes I received were very expensive. After shopping around, the lowest quote I found was over $2,800 for 6 months, while the highest was over $3,000. Fortunately, I was able to join a supportive adults policy, which significantly lowered the premium for me. However, this option isn't available to everyone. If I hadn't had a generous person willing to let me be added to their policy, I would have been left uninsured. That would have led to my bank either repossessing my car or forcing me to pay for a policy, tacking that onto my car loan, further increasing my debt and financial instability. HF 2215 addresses a public safety concern and protects not just those who can't afford car insurance, but everyone on the road. This is an opportunity for you to create a more equitable system that ensures all drivers are insured, reducing the risk of accidents and financial instability for young people, and while promoting safer roads for all Minnesotans. Thank you so much.
Up next is Katia Zepeda, and if Aaron Cocking, if you could also come up to the testifiers table. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Katia Zepeda, and I serve as the Director of Advocacy, Community Engagement, and Equity for the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation. And I am here in support of House File 2215, the Minnesota Lifeline Program. One of our top legislative priorities at the foundation is housing. The City of St. Paul has identified zip code 551066 as having one of the highest eviction rates in the region, with $53 being the average amount owed in unpaid rent. The rising cost of living is a key factor impacting the rise of eviction rates in this area. Through our emergency grant program, we know that just the slightest interruption from a repair bill to a parking ticket can completely derail someone's life. In 2024, auto insurance rates in Minnesota were projected to jump by 61%, making this one of the biggest increases in the country. Unfortunately, this zip code, 55106, was also identified as having one of the highest auto insurance rates in the state. As you have heard from others, basic liability insurance is priced on non-driving factors such as level of education, marital status, gender, and credit score. Making this one-time appropriation to the self-sustaining program would not only make Minnesota's roads safer, but it would help cut this discriminatory practice towards our low-income residents. People are being evicted over $53 in debt. So if this Lifeline program can save people $100 a month on their insurance, that could make a huge difference. I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the Minnesota Lifeline program, and I highly encourage the committee to please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Zepeda. Up next is Aaron Cocking, and if Joe Carlson, if you could also come up, you'll be our last testifier. Mr. Cocking, please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Cocking. I'm the President and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. As most of you know, the IFM represents the property and casualty insurers doing business in Minnesota, including companies that collectively represent three-quarters of the auto insurance premiums in the state. This bill is very concerning and has unintended consequences that will negatively affect companies and leave Minnesota policyholders paying more. While I'm limited to 2 minutes, I'll focus on three main issues as fast as I can. First and foremost, consumers purchasing insurance in the standard market will be forced to subsidize this program for a select group of participants. That's because, according to the proponents, when the program runs a deficit, which it will, costs will be assessed to auto insurers, adding costs to the standard market and raising serious financial and fairness issues. We do know that standard market consumers will pay a surcharge to fund marketing and outreach for the program, and that surcharge will trigger retaliatory tax consequences for Minnesota-domiciled insurance companies doing business in other states. And the administrative cost of collecting this fee may exceed the amount actually collected. Second, the 25% cap on geographic premium variations likely forces policyholders in greater Minnesota to subsidize policyholders in the metro area despite meaningful differences in risk profiles. Third, policies issued under this program should be subject to the same consumer protection requirements as laws as standard policies. This includes market conduct, data privacy, data security, cancellation, and non-renewal rules. This bill also does not require physical damage coverage for these policies, making them of no value to anyone who finances a vehicle and must satisfy lien holder or lessor insurance requirements. In closing, the insurance industry has raised these concerns since this bill surfaced 6 years ago, and unfortunately, the bill has not improved much with age. Simply put, subsidized rates for one group of policyholders will lead to higher premiums for other insured drivers. That's not good policy, and it's surely not good for the 90% of drivers who have insurance now. If we are truly serious about improving insurance affordability, we should focus on addressing the real cost drivers impacting all Minnesota drivers, not carve them out for a state-run program for select few. This means tackling risky driving behavior, soaring vehicle repair costs, and legal system abuse. These are the issues driving up premiums across the board, and solving them benefits everyone, not just some consumers. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Our last testifier is Joel Carlson. Identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, which is a professional association of lawyers across the state of Minnesota that represent people that are injured through someone else's fault or negligence. And we support the goals of this bill, absolutely. Everyone wants to have lower insurance rates. Our issues are more technical in nature with how the bill is constructed. Minnesota's financial responsibility laws are based on the premise that the motoring public should bear the costs of automobile accidents. This bill shifts that burden to private employer insurance, to the government, or to the person injured themselves because they don't have any coverage at all. We think that moves us away from the goal of what we have had in Minnesota on our compulsory insurance since 1940, that the cost of automobile accidents should be borne by the motoring public. This bill removes the medical pay provision of our auto insurance. So if you're injured in an accident and you don't have one of the other coverages, or you thought you had it and you don't, that provides uncompensated care, and you will find providers that are unwilling to treat auto accident victims, which I don't think helps anyone. The bill doesn't really provide any limits on the value of a vehicle. Like California has been mentioned, they have a $25,000 limit on the vehicle that you can insure under this program. Our underinsured rates in Minnesota is actually, according to the Insurance Information Institute, is 8.7. California, with this low-cost option, is about 17%. So we think there are ways that we can get at this issue without selling what we think is substandard insurance to people who have low incomes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And we are out of time, members. I know there's a number of people waiting to testify, but I'm waiting to have comments, but this bill is being laid over. I'm going to give the last word to to Co-Chair O'Driscoll, and then any final comments from Representative Hollins. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Personal injury protection is not only to protect the injuries of a own vehicle owner and insurance holder, it is also designed to protect the legally, and I want to point to underscore legally uninsured persons who might be involved in an accident. In addition to medical benefits, it also provides replacement services and additional coverage. It is a $1 coverage. There is no deductible on personal injury protection. If an individual is forced to go to their own homeowners, or excuse me, to their own health insurance policy, where they may have a large deductible and a large copay, there is no insurance whatsoever, and it creates additional uncompensated care, which this committee is very, very aware of. In addition to that, if a person doesn't have insurance, they may end up having to go to the Medicaid system, which is horribly backlogged right now in taking applications, evidenced by the experiences that Regents Hospital is having here in St. Paul. And finally, it also tinkers around with the uninsured motorist coverage, a motorcycle coverage, which will continue to drive the cost of that. This bill is not ready to be passed out of this committee and needs a lot of work. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. And Representative Hollins, any quick final comments?
Thank you so much for allowing us to have this bill heard. I want to note that when we talk about where the cost is coming from, the insurance industry made $88 billion in profits last year. So saying that it's the reason that we are in this situation with rising costs has nothing to do with whether people are safe or not. It has to do with a industry that is designed to make profit. And so what we are trying to do is fill in a gap for a market that is sorely lacking. I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation, and I hope we can continue talking about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. This bill is laid over, and we are adjourned.